The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Dr. Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan, and an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, D.C. And he's also a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And Jack, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you on again.
Thanks, Roger. It's nice to be with you.
Oh, well, and speaking of being on the show, about this time last year, you were on the show talking about the global defense outlook, and today we're going to focus on, probably the most important region in the world, the Asia-Pacific region, and the defense environment there. But, since you've been on the show, you've relocated to Tokyo.
Yes.
You're doing the same things, but I guess some different things. Can you talk a little bit about the move and why and how you're enjoying it, too? It sounds like it's a very interesting place.
Sure. The move's been great. Tokyo is a wonderful city. Our clients in the region, both government clients and commercial, have started to ask for more help around the difficult transition that Japan is making in defense. So we decided to focus more of our global resources on helping the Japanese government and Japanese industry deal with the emerging defense challenges that they face. And it was a very natural thing for us to bring more of our global resources to bear in Tokyo, and that's why I moved.
Right, and I understand you're really enjoying the city
Tokyo
itself.
Tokyo is wonderful. It really is one of the jewels of the planet, and people who haven't been there should go. It's wonderful.
Right, great. So let's turn to the topic at hand, and I know you are working on a report focusing on the Asia Pacific defense outlook for 2015, and I guess the working title or what you're focusing the theme is tension, collaboration, and convergence. And so my first question, which that's a great title because it catches the reader's eye right off the top. Why that subtitle, tension, collaboration, and convergence?
As we thought about the broad changes that are happening across Asia Pacific, we wanted to capture that in a very succinct way. And we thought that those three words, tension, collaboration, and convergence, give a good sense of what's happening in Asia. Tension, in the sense that there is so much change going on that policymakers are experiencing a great deal of tension in responding to those changes. Collaboration, because collaboration between countries, a lot of bilateral relationships are emerging. We wouldn't say community, but we would say collaboration between countries despite the rising tension. And convergence, because Asia is developing very rapidly, and particularly in the security and defense area, our Asia-Pacific neighbors are racing toward the global technology frontier. The distance, the technical distance between Western militaries and Asia-Pacific militaries is closing very fast, and we think that may be an irrevocable change as well as an inevitable one.
Sure.
So we thought that those three words gave a good sense of what's happening in the region.
Yeah, and we're going to cover each of those areas and sort of talk today about what does that mean to the United States, what does it mean for mm-hmm. Asia-Pacific region in general, and looking at that outlook and where will we be maybe 4 years from now, 2018. But I guess first, let's set the sort of stage and what you're looking at. And so my first question is, when you're talking Asia-Pacific, who are we talking about? What countries are the players, the big players? What does that region look like from your perspective?
To define Asia-Pacific, we use the 25 countries that are part of certainly the United States, which is very much a Pacific
sure.
nation,
yep.
but also ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and we kind of built around that. So we looked at the ASEAN countries, the ASEAN plus three, the East Asia Summit, the Asia Regional Forum, and then, of course, you have to factor in North Korea as well.
Right.
So our definition of Asia—
whatever they are, right?
Whatever they are, and it's hard to get reliable information about North Korea. So our definition of Asia Pacific ranges from Pakistan all the way to California. And we looked at those countries which are actually spending money on defense. So those 25 countries represent, when we looked at that set, that's about 58% of the population of the earth.
Wow.
And more than 40% of the economic output of the world occurs in those 25 countries.
Okay. And you know, when you're looking at that subset of countries, what are some of the key trends that we're obviously going to address them? But the key trends, obviously, the defense spending is growing significantly. And what do you see over the next 4 years?
We were really struck by the speed and intensity at which defense budgets are growing in the region. Around the world, globally, we think defense spending will rise about 5% between 2014 and 2018. That's worldwide. But in the Asia-Pacific countries, excluding the United States because that's such a huge budget, in the non-U.S. Asia-Pacific countries, defense budgets will rise by 20% in the next 4 years. That's a huge change. It will shift the global balance in defense spending such that by 2018, we think that for the first time, the Asia-Pacific countries, ex-U.S., will actually spend as much on defense as the United States and more than Europe. So this is it's a sea change. It's a fundamental change in the defense environment. And one has to ask why is this happening? What's driving it? And that's what really pushed our research.
Right. Well, we'll get to that why question.
Sure.
Let's take a look at some of the countries. I understand that there's sort of a big three within those 25. There's, I guess, seven lower income countries that are sort of leading the charge and the growth that's spending. But there's big three.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about them?
Well, of course, in Asia Pacific, China.
Right. That's a big one, right there.
China's a big one. It spends about 34% of the total regional defense budget. Again, I'm excluding the United States now, but about a third of the regional budget is China alone. Russia adds another 15%. Japan adds another 11%. India 9 and Korea 6. So those are the big spenders in Asia Pacific. The rest of the Asia Pacific countries add about a quarter of the total spent. So China has very much emerged as the key spender, and that's a very different world than we lived in even as recently as the turn of the century, and certainly a huge change from a few decades ago. By 2018, China's share will increase. And it will be spending nearly 40% of the regional defense budget, far outweighing, for example, the Japanese, whose budget will only be about 9% of Asia-Pacific spending. So there's the dynamic is changing fundamentally. And the rise of China, Russia, and now India, I think, is the real story.
Right. And focusing on China,
mm-hmm.
the investments they're making, the spending they're doing, it's driven by... Can you talk about the factors that they think, that country is thinking about when it's making its decisions on spending, just generally, like what's driving their push?
We took an economic look, and China's defense budget tracks very closely the economic growth of the country, and we should keep that kind of uppermost in mind. China has changed fundamentally from the country that it was 50 years ago to the country that it is today. And as it has become more wealthy, there's more money to spend. The way to understand that is to look at defense spending as a fraction of the national product. If China were militarizing, you would see it increase devoting an increased share of its national
GDP,
product
yeah.
to defense.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see that. You see actually a lower share of China's GDP going to defense than you do in the United States, much lower. And that share has actually declined somewhat as China has modernized. So I think it would be a bit hasty to view that as militarization.
Right.
We can see it through an economic lens as simply a product of development.
Right. The greater growth, the percentage, the actual dollar figure gets higher because it's a
bigger economy.
Right.
Exactly. It's as simple as that.
6% of 200 is more than 6% of 100, right?
Yes. Or in right. China's case, about 1.5%
yeah.
of.
Okay. Well, we do have to take a break.
Yeah.
This session's going fast already. It's one of my favorite things to talk about. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu in Tokyo, Japan. We're focusing on the Asian Pacific defense environment. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about India and Russia, and then look at a little bit of the tension issue, the collaboration and the convergence. We'll start getting more focused on that after we've completed setting the stage. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. He's here in the States visiting, and I'm fortunate to get Jack to come into the studio and talk about the Asia-Pacific defense environment. And you know, when we took the break, Jack, you had touched on Chinese approach to defense, why their defense budget is growing from your perspective, and I wanted to touch on the two others of the big three in Asia Pacific, and I guess first because it's fascinating to me is Russia, and its defense outlook, especially with current events and the way the gas prices have. And oil prices have collapsed. The ruble's under extreme stress mm-hmm. right now. And how does that all factor into what projections are for Russia? Is it going to change projections that you were? Is it changes you're thinking any or what? I'll open it up. Let you just start and talk a little bit about Russia and where they are.
Russia's defense problem is unique in the world. It faces both Europe and Asia. And so when we think about Russian defense policy, we have to recognize that they have both theaters. They have both parts of the planet to deal with in a country that crosses 11 time zones and stretches from Murmansk to Vladivostok. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to defend and a lot of different threats that present. What's happening in Russia is a recapitalization on a scale that has not happened in the post-Soviet period. And so over the next few years, we see the defense budget rising by over 20%, about 22% by 2018. And frankly, that may not change. They may emphasize it because of the economic value, the industrial development value associated with defense spending. They are planning, the Russians say they are planning to increase procurement, that is the amount of money they spend to buy new systems and weapons by 43% over the next 4 years, and they're increasing research and development spending by over a quarter. That's a huge increase, and it reflects a deep fundamental commitment to modernizing Russian defense. So we don't see that as something that's likely to change. The Russians took delivery on 40 new ICBMs, 210 aircraft, and two new ballistic missile submarines. That is a level of capitalization that we just haven't seen post-Soviet. So they've also established a new branch of service, a cyber branch of service. They're doing some things around military compensation. Russia intends to maintain a world-class military, and one can well understand why, given the neighborhood in which they work.
Right, so that it's their neighborhood. It sounds like it can also be a part of an economic development, sort of program, your jobs program to a certain extent. That, when you talk about the stress on the economy there and the ruble, it's a way to make investments.
Well, if you listen to what President Putin actually says in public to audiences in Russia, he views economic development. He views defense as a key driver of the economic development of the country. Most of Russia's economy is driven by extraction. It's
right.
natural resource based. if he's going to build a manufacturing base, if he's going to build a high technology base, defense is a great place for him to operate. And it's clear from everything he said and now from everything he spends that they intend to use defense in exactly that way. To open the door with China, Russia is talking a lot about cooperative security arrangements in Asia Pacific to kind of counterbalance unilateral Chinese influence and also U.S. influence. But the Chinese aren't quite as excited about that. The Russians need to cooperate with the Chinese, and they are building a world-class military, rebuilding a world-class yeah. military to get that done.
All right. And it's core to their overall approach to foreign policy. And
right.
Just, right.
And again, one can read that as militarization, or you can read that as a prudent set of economic development measures being taken by a world leader who perceives threats in both directions, both from east and west.
Yeah. Okay, that's fascinating. India, to me, is a fascinating place too as well. It's the largest democracy in the world, right? Growing economy, not like China, not at the rate China is, I don't think. You'll correct me if I'm wrong on that.
You're right.
But also, I think potentially seeing threats, right? Pakistan on one side, and I don't know how they I know they're skeptical of the Chinese, I would say, would be fair. But your thoughts on India?
Mr. Modi has got a really tough challenge ahead economically. He has to grow India's economy, and he is visibly committed to using the defense budget as a way to build indigenous Indian manufacturing capability. So he's doing a couple of things. He's boosting the budget tremendously. So the Indian budget will go up by a third over the next 4 years.
Wow.
And he will raise research and development spending by 55%. It's one of the biggest jumps in R&D spending that we're seeing worldwide, and it's happening in India. So he's putting the resources to bear, but he's also changing the laws. So for the first time, it will be possible for foreign companies to do direct ownership up to 49% of Indian defense enterprises. That has never been the case. India's always avoided that, but now they've opened the door. That also allows a much greater contribution for foreign direct investment. So he's looking for an infusion of foreign manufacturing technologies and so forth. They are also doing
so. Just a question.
Sure.
So is that? I mean, you see that as a natural play for American defense companies.
It is. It is. But not just for American defense companies. The Japanese are very interested in figuring out how to work with the Indian government and with Indian industry. And they're taking some very active steps in that direction now that Japanese companies are allowed to export defense articles. That's a new policy just effective this year. So I think the time is ripe over these next few years for a huge jump in Indian military capability, but also in the ability of Indian industry to manufacture and eventually to export military technology.
So I have to ask: are the English a player there too? Given former colony,
everybody's a player.
Everybody's a player.
The door's been shut. Everybody's been knocking. Mr. Modi has now opened the door by encouraging foreign direct investment in defense, and that is a fundamental change that Modi has put into place that has never been available to foreign companies.
Now, historically, another follow-up question on that. Now, historically. Yeah, Soviet Union, India had a close relationship. Mm-hmm. Non-aligned country, and they're I think defense-wise as well in terms of providing equipment. The Russians. So, are they going to be a player too? Or are they going to be so focused on their own internal, trying to grow their own indigenous industry or recapitalizing it?
Modi is a very practical politician, so he's maintaining a good relationship with Russia and China, but he has also tremendously expanded the relationship with the United States. So the United States has just recently entered into co-production agreements, so we will be able to manufacture American weapons systems and technology in India. And, you know, the United States has now replaced Russia as the biggest foreign supplier of defense equipment to India. That's new. And those deepening ties between Washington and Delhi have another reason. One of the underlying reasons is that India wants to be able to conduct civil nuclear development without being constrained by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it has never signed. And the expanded U.S. cooperation with Delhi gives them some room to do that. So he's committed to development, and we should see what he's doing around defense as part of a broader scheme to develop the Indian economy.
Okay, great. You know, and Jack, we're at the next break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Midgley. He's a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And when we come back, we'll start focusing even more. I mean, we've talked about a lot of the environment. We can talk about the tension, talk a little bit about collaboration and convergence, get into that discussion even in a bit more detail. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. He's also an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, D.C. And finally, he's also a member, amongst many other things, as a member of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And Jack, when we when we took that break, we had been talking about Russia and India, and the part of the big three, along with China, in terms of driving Asia Pacific spending, and that's it's almost like, well, it is, as you point out, and you talk about tension in the region as part of tension, collaboration, and convergence. That's sort of the new, and I'll throw Russia in as new because they've they're relatively new. It's not the Soviet Union anymore. But India and China, emerging, economic powers, developing countries, versus the older, Japan, even the United States, South Korea to a certain extent. Can you talk, in the dynamic in terms of economic growth and the budget, what we've talked in terms of budget growth? I think in one of the earlier segments you contrasted, the percent of defense spending that China by 2018 of overall regional spend would be 40-some% versus Japan about 10%. How we all know that change creates tension and uncertainty. Can you talk about what it means, in this region from a defense outlook and what folks are thinking about? It's a big question, but...
Well, it's a big question. I think it's the right question, too. You can see this. You can choose to see this as kind of the Asian upstarts versus the establishment countries, but I think that that doesn't quite do it justice. What we're seeing is different and even more profound than old versus new. Out of the ashes of the Second World War, after 70 years, Asia is beginning to approach the standard of economic development previously enjoyed only in the West. It's not that there is hostility or that the West has declined. It's that the Asia-Pacific countries are catching up. And as their standard of living rises, there's more to defend. There are more power plants. There are more ATMs. There's more broadband. There's more stuff to defend. There are more economic interests to defend, and there's more capability to buy defense. So we shouldn't necessarily be troubled by the fact that the Asian Pacific countries can now afford and are building fifth generation fighters and aircraft carriers and advanced submarines. That's not necessarily a threat. It's a concomitant of economic development. I think it's important to keep that economic perspective in view as we think about policy responses to what's happening in the region.
Right. And with those changes, so you have Japan that is a Western type economy in sense of its development and where it is. And China, that is, you know, still developing, and its internet is growing, and its you know, broadband, all the things you meant, power plants and more things to defend. I guess my question is, do the neighbors see that as a, as you've described, sort of a natural or potentially natural outgrowth of economic development? We've talked earlier in segment about they're not militarization. You can look as an indicator the percentage of GDP that a country is defending, spending on defense, and China, that percentage is not growing. So that's a very leading indicator. But how do those countries surrounding China see the country and what it's doing? And, you know, one of the interesting, fascinating things that you mentioned to me offline is this collaboration but confrontation that China is very good at. Can you talk a little bit about how others see them, and does that drive defense spending at all?
Of course,
in terms
it does.
Of how they.
Of course, it does. And any prudent defense planner, whether he's in South Korea or India or Washington D.C., looks at capability. And as Chinese capability increases, a good military planner will say the threat from China increases. That's an objective fact. It's created by capability. The fact that capability comes along with development is not real interesting if your business is defense planning. You have to deal with the actual capability. The Chinese kind of complicate this a little bit because of the very sophisticated policy that combines collaboration and confrontation at the same time. The best illustration of that is their policy toward Japan. Japan is their number one economic trading partner. It is the second largest, after the United States, source of foreign direct investment in China. The two economies are closely interlinked, and you couldn't tease them apart. You couldn't do it.
Right.
At the same time, China confronts Japan over what can seem to an outsider like a marginal issue, the Diaoyu Senkaku issue, and one can say, well, you know, why is that happening? China is simply asserting its national interest. It's making a claim to sovereignty. It's taking a step onto the world stage, and we can expect that to continue. But we shouldn't we shouldn't assume that the policy only has one dimension. It has both. It will continue to collaborate. It has to, and it will continue to confront as China grows.
Right. And I don't know if this is the right question. It's maybe unsophisticated. But the end game, what is, when you're thinking about China's intentions, let's say, or just where do they want to be in terms of their role in Asia Pacific? I mean, obviously they want to, they're reasserting a historical sort of perspective of where it should be. How does that human dynamic from a sort of emotional, philosophical, view, how does that play into when you're thinking about, how to manage that relationship if you're Japan? Or I don't know if that question makes sense or not.
It makes a lot of sense, and I think a lot of people are wrestling with it. The Chinese tell us. It's not a secret. They intend to be at the global technology frontier by 2020. They intend to increase the standard of living of the Chinese people so that they enjoy the same level of lifestyle that we do in the West. That's what the government is trying to do. And in order to do that, China's economic interests have to be defended. So we can expect them to be very aggressive, as the United States would be, as Britain would be, as Japan would be, in the defense of its own interests. That doesn't mean that there has to be conflict, but we shouldn't expect China to punch below its weight, and it won't.
Right. Yeah, they're in the weight room working out, right?
Yep.
Absolutely. Just a quick, another thing that I know you've touched on are a couple areas that. And that quickly, maybe we can just chat. It's hard to do it quickly on this, but one of the areas of tension, or I guess the wild card in some of what's going on is terrorism, right? And in the Asia Pacific area. And I just want to get your thoughts on, you know, what that how that dynamic plays into it. You know, we've seen some horrific recent events, you know, in Pakistan, and you know, where there's obviously a boatload of of incidents and a huge challenge. And how does, you know, even in China, you know, there's more recently, in, you know, over the last couple of years, every once in a while there's an incident there. And terrorism also ties into cyber. I mean, you know, whether people are, you know, hacking networks. You know, we've got the, you know, we just recently had the issue with the movie and the Sony hacking. And, you know, those are sort of two distinct issues, but they're also related. And, you know, I don't know if it's fair to put them together, but I want to get your thoughts on those two.
It might be fair. I'm going to take them apart.
Okay, that would be good.
On the terrorism issue, we think of terrorism as a global problem, and in some ways it is. But it's in Asia, it presents different aspects. There are five countries in Asia that represent about a third of all the terrorism that happens in the world. Those five countries, of course, are Pakistan, Philippines, India, Thailand, and Bangladesh. If you those five places, and it's mostly Pakistan, account for a third of all the terrorism in the world. All of the other Asia Pacific countries, the other 20, represent only 1% of global terrorism. So there aren't a lot of terrorist incidents outside the five Asia Pacific countries. However, all of the defense ministries express concern about avoiding any increase in terrorism in the future. Singapore, very watchful, in particular, around, and Malaysia, Indonesia are very concerned about the possibility of extremism. So terrorism isn't a uniform problem across the region. Cyber, to take that issue.
Well, that's okay. Right. That's a good, right there we can take a break and you can tackle cyber when we come back.
Perfect.
From that break. But my guest today is Jack Midgley. He's a director at Deloitte Tsumatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about cyber. We'll talk about an interesting dynamic of bilateral agreements versus multilateral in the Asia Pacific region. And finally, we'll do a little convergence at the very end of the show. A lot still to cover. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tsumatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan. And I'm fortunate to have grabbed him, got him into my studio when he's here in D.C. And Jack, when we took the break, you were about to talk a little bit about the cyber dynamic and, you know, the tension or just where it is in the Asia Pacific region and what does it mean?
Well, we noticed in the course of building our Asia Pacific outlook that every military, without exception, every military in the region is building some level of cyber capability. That would not have been the case even 5 years ago. But because their infrastructure is developing and because these countries are beginning to depend on things like ATMs and internet commerce to reach the rest of the world, military planners are thinking about and implementing cyber. Not everybody talks about this. So it's hard to get the same kind of solid fact-based picture that you can get when you want to talk about tanks or ships. But everyone has sent the signal that they are working in this area. So that's on the capability side. On the threat side, it's equally difficult to get a really clear picture of what's happening because so much of this activity is unreported, particularly attacks against companies. Companies don't like to talk about this in public. Mm-hmm. And in Asia Pacific, they just don't do it. When we looked around for good public information, and that's all we use is public information about where internet attack traffic is coming from, we turned to some of the software vendors who support this industry, and it seems pretty clear that most of the internet attack traffic is coming in the world is coming from China, India, frankly, the United States, but also Taiwan, Indonesia, and Russia. So the countries in the Asia Pacific, seven of them account for a very high percentage of reported global cyber attack traffic. So the region is clearly a hotbed for cyber activity. And of course, our numbers didn't include North Korea, which is now very much in the headlines.
Right. What does that say? I mean, the immediate question popped in my head. What does that say about Europe if they're not in the... I assume they're doing it as well. Are they quieter about it, less effective, or can you even really tell?
I don't know. I don't know what it means. Yeah. The fact that there are relatively fewer cyber attacks coming from Germany and France, I think may indicate the relative sophistication of surveillance and policing in those countries. And the relative ease of doing it from elsewhere.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This kind of traffic is going to move to where it's easiest to do. And at the moment, that appears to be Asia Pacific.
Right. So another area I wanted to touch on is collaboration a little bit more. We've talked about it some in the show. But you've made the point that the collaboration is bilateral, much more than multilateral. And can you talk a little bit about a couple examples, and what does that bilateral mean in the big picture in terms of the relationships across the region?
Well, for people who are used to thinking about European, the sort of classic Cold War European security, it was contending alliances. It was huge it was NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and those were contending alliances made up of countries at relatively similar levels of development, each with a superpower behind them. That dynamic doesn't work in Asia Pacific. The countries are at different levels, very different levels of economic development. And we still have Russia, China, India, and Japan as contending leaders. So no center of gravity has ever emerged in Asia Pacific for a regional alliance. Instead, the countries in Asia Pacific are very practical. They deal with each other bilaterally, issue by issue. And in some cases, they deal bilaterally to kind of set the framework or the context for their defense relationship. We're very interested in the Australia-Japan relationship that's emerging right now, which some in Japan have characterized as a quasi-alliance. Very strong language. But what's happening there between Australia and Japan is co-production agreements, export agreements. The Australians are going to buy, we think, about a half a dozen Soryu-class submarines from Japan. There's a big question about where will they be built. Will they be built in Japan or in Australia? Fine. But that the Japanese Ministry of Defense has established for the first time a shop dedicated entirely to the Australia-Japan relationship. That has only happened before in the context of the U.S.-Japan relationship. So these kinds of bilateral agreements are happening all across the region. There's a network, a very complex one, of bilateral agreements taking shape. On the multilateral side, all you really have is ASEAN at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And ASEAN was never intended to be region-wide, and it was never intended as a defense alliance. But ASEAN has now formed a group called the ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting. So they're meeting a couple times a year, and they're doing practical, limited things like humanitarian assistance and disaster relief coordination. They've set up direct communication links between their ministries of defense, although China is not part of that. They've set up a logistics support framework. They're trying to do a better job of coordinating defense industries. But we haven't seen, and I don't think we will see, as far out as we can look, any kind of consolidated regional alliance like we're accustomed to seeing with NATO.
Right. And how does the United States play in that? In terms, you talked about the Australian-Japanese growing relationship, and we are allies of both those countries, and so how does mean, how does that relate to those, what those two are doing together? Or does it not?
It clearly it does relate. I think in both cases, Australia and Japan, the relationship with the United States is rock solid. But the level of commitment, the forward commitment and presence by the United States is changing as our defense budgets and priorities change. So prudent planners in both countries will conclude maybe we need to rely a little less on U.S. support and a little more on what we can do bilaterally together. And I think that's part of the impetus behind the Australia-Japan relationship. We have talked a lot about pivot to Pacific, but I have to say from Tokyo, it's hard to see.
See that. Yeah. So, and how does South Korea play in these bilateral relationships? Like
South Korea's, of course, the South Korea-U.S. relationship is very solid, but it is changing. South Korea's challenge, one of many challenges, is demographic. They've traditionally relied on a draft military, and the number of draft-age young men has dropped substantially. So South Korea has decided to cut the size of its ground forces by about 20% over the next few years. Yeah, it's very substantial. And they are going to rely more on technology. So at the same time that's happening, the U.S. is sending a very strong signal that they want the South Koreans to step up in terms of command and control of wartime operations. That date has been – the date at which the Koreans would actually take that commitment on has been pushed back. And it's adding, a level of tension in the U.S.-Korean relationship.
Yeah, so you mentioned the reliance on technology. Another – you know, this, quickly we can talk about convergence. And you've identified one of the key trends in defense spending is – the increase in procurement dollars and R&D dollars is the fastest growing elements of the Asian Pacific, you know, budgets. And what are the implications of that vis-a-vis the United States? So you talked about, you know, China being top end technology capabilities by, you know, 2020, right? And what does that, you know, what are you seeing and what are the implications do you see?
All across the region, what we see is technology approaching U.S. standards. That can be perceived as a failure in the United States. It's not. It's inevitable. It's the result of development-driven catch-up by these countries. So, you know, in China, we're talking about the J-31 fighter aircraft as a competitor with the F-35. Most people would say technically it's not quite there, but it will be. It'll get there. The Chinese are talking about exporting the J-31. They haven't made a deal yet, but they're going to try. Japan has advanced anti-submarine aircraft, like the Kawasaki's P-1. They're interested in exporting it. That technology is world-class technology. It's the best there is. They've constrained themselves up to now from exporting, but they're going to be driven to export by the high cost of producing that kind of technology. Yeah. So the world is approaching... and it's going to continue to approach the U.S. technical limit. It's going to get harder and harder for the U.S. to achieve any kind of unique or long-term technical advantage, not because we've failed or because we aren't clever, but because the rest of the world is catching up. And one can view that in a positive way. As the world gets richer and more advanced, one can hope it might be a little more peaceful.
Right, a little more rational, let's say.
Well, anyone can. That may be a bridge too far.
So if you're, you know, sort of last question, if you're sitting in, you know, crafting, you know, how the United States responds to this, I know that's a big, we could do a whole show on that, but just what are some of the key things that, you know, the United States should be thinking about in terms of, you know, so if technology is going to be equal, what does that mean for how we are defense planning? What does it mean for how we approach that region? Just some quick thoughts.
Yeah, I think first the most essential fact is we have to treat this as an economically driven phenomenon, and we have to deal with it in economic terms. bilaterally when we have to, multilaterally when we can, but we have to recognize that this isn't militarization necessarily. It shouldn't be characterized that way. It's development. And that enables us to take economic policy actions rather than offset with military. That's, I think, the most important point. The second point is that we are going to see competition for U.S. systems, technology, and therefore influence as these countries begin to export advanced systems. There's a business opportunity for American defense companies and service companies there, but there is also an emerging competitive threat as these countries have more to offer and as they become more sophisticated in selling advanced defense technology. So that in that respect, the defense market is going to become more complicated and
more
multipolar
yeah.
than it has been recently. And with the huge increase in R&D and procurement spending that we see in Asia Pacific over the next few years, I think you're going to see American and European defense companies paying a lot more attention to what's happening in Japan, China, and India, but also in the smaller countries because they are spending more and they're looking for more advanced technology.
Great. You know, we could do two or three shows on this, Jack, and it's great to have you on. I want to thank my guest today, Jack Midgley. Jack is a director at Deloitte Tohmatsu Consulting in Tokyo, Japan, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.